Let's pretend I tell you something and I want you to write it down. What do? Do you reach for a pen and paper? Do you type it into your computer, your phone? Do you maybe use your phone to make an audio recording that your phone can then automatically transcribe into text? What are we talking about anymore when we talk about writing something down? Is that as outdated as saying that you're going to dial a phone number, which a lot of people still say, even though phones haven't had dials for a long time? Is handwriting a technology that served its purpose until something better came along? Or is it an essential part of who we are, how we process information, how we think? That is our question of the day here at Freakonomics Radio. When we asked you, our listeners, to tell us what you think about handwriting, it was immediately clear that there's no consensus.
Writing by hand is expressive and personal and connects to the part of my brain that is creative and is seeking the answer.
I still take notes all day long, but they're full of screenshots because the software is very visual these days. So welcome to the future. I don't miss the pen and the paper.
I still prefer cursive since it helps me to remember things and is a distraction-free form of note-taking.
I don't see why handwriting should be mandatory in school anymore.
I have to write everything down. Every note that I take in class, I handwrite.
I type far faster than I write, and I find when I write, my hands can't keep up with how fast I think.
I'm guessing that you identify with at least one of these people. Maybe you love every curly letter as it pours out of your pen, or maybe you're still scarred by your childhood handwriting failures, as some of us are. In any case, today we will get into the science of handwriting.
What we found in our studies is that laptop note takers did significantly worse than students who took notes longhand.
But is the pro-handwriting movement the sinister position of... Hey, can I get some dramatic music here? Is it the sinister position of big pencil and big pen?
When you read studies about how cursive helps you become smarter, look to see who funds those.
And we visit a shop in New York with a very specific product line.
New pencils, rare pencils, antique pencils, novelty pencils, pencil accessories, books about pencils, really beautiful sharpeners.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
How much has our written communication been changing? The U.S. Postal Service tells us that Americans send roughly 20 billion first-class pieces of mail a year, which sounds like a lot, but just a decade ago, we sent well over twice as many. What about emails? That number went from zero just a few decades ago to more than 200 billion a day globally. According to a study done by an online letter printing outfit called DocMail, one in three respondents had not written anything substantial by hand in the previous 6 months. Our schools, meanwhile, have been reassessing how kids are taught to write. The Common Core is a set of standards and curriculum guidelines for U.S. schools that's been adopted by more than 40 states. It still advocates learning to print, but it doesn't even mention cursive. To some people, this is an abomination.
There are counties who are teaching cursive writing and counties who are not. Now, that was unbelievable to me, that we would graduate students who could never read a founding document.
In 2014, Tennessee state legislator Sheila Butt introduced a bill requiring all elementary schools in her state to teach cursive.
I have right here the Declaration of Independence. I'm thankful that I can read that. I have a Bill of Rights, and I can read that. And I believe if we're going to educate our students, that they deserve a right to know what's in their past. They need to know the traditions and the founding documents of this country. And they need to be able to read those.
Now, Butt's argument may strike you as fairly narrow. We don't all learn Hebrew in order to read the Bible, so do we really need to learn cursive just to read the Declaration of Independence? But she is right that the handwriting is on the wall for handwriting, at least for cursive. Back in 2006, when the SAT exam introduced a new handwritten essay question, only 15% of the students wrote their answers in cursive. Some schools do want to preserve the tradition of cursive, even if it's not utilitarian. One district in Ohio has moved the instruction of cursive into the art department. So there does seem to be a massive decline in handwriting, especially cursive handwriting. Does it matter? Might there be some hidden costs worth thinking about?
There's some very solid research, and it's called the handwriting effect, and that is students who have more legible handwriting do score better on tests, and this will be true of high-stakes tests as well.
That's Anne Trubeck. She is the author of a book called The History and Uncertain Future of Handwriting.
I was a professor at Oberlin College, and my focus was on the history of writing and writing technologies.
So Trubeck says the handwriting effect research shows a correlation between good handwriting and good test scores.
Not only is there definitely a more qualitative perception amongst teachers that kids with better handwriting are smarter, but it's also been, you know, proven in research studies, and it does continue to those tests that are very important and are scored, you know, anonymously.
You argued that we kind of connect penmanship to character and or really learning and learning ability, right?
Right. We Americans of the last 100, 150 years connect penmanship with individuality, with our sense of self. And we also have a shared memory of being taught penmanship as a very crucial part of our early schooling days. It's very unique that way. I can't think of many other things that so many Americans would share as a common memory that are alive today.
Hearing Trubeck, you might think she's an advocate for continuing to teach cursive and for stressing good penmanship, but you would be wrong. So in 2008, you wrote an article for Good Magazine called Stop Teaching Handwriting. Talk about that for a moment, why you wrote the article and whether that was the beginning of something for you or the middle or I assume not the end.
Right. That's a good question. I'd say it was really the middle. The impulse to write it came from watching my son, who was then, I think, in second grade, struggle quite a bit in school because he had poor handwriting. And I was very aware that in my son's adult life, handwriting was going to be a very small percentage of what he needed to do. And yet, he was having to stay in every single day for recess of second grade because he got his G's backwards.
What did that do to his feelings about school and feelings about learning generally?
It was really detrimental. He really thought he was bad at school. I mean, I ended up actually transferring him to a private school, and this was a lot of the reason why. And they said, oh, you know, he's school damaged. And it also worked on him cognitively so that he started to believe that he didn't have any good ideas, because the difficulty of technically being able to make a letter was transferred to a difficulty expressing himself.
So you wrote this article that was influenced by your son's trouble in school learning writing, but you made a broader argument that what?
My argument was that elementary schools were putting too much emphasis on penmanship in their curriculum and that it should be de-emphasized given changes in technology, and the idea that it was going to be preparing kids for the future was more questionable.
So what was the response like to your article?
It just went viral. And the comments were extraordinarily nasty and negative. A lot of it was, you know, sort of, I'm a bad mother. If I really cared, I would, you know, spend more time teaching my son how to write correctly or things like that. And that I didn't understand the importance of education and knowledge. And then there was a lot of, you know, what's next? We're all going to have computer chips in our heads sorts of, you know, slippery slope logic comments.
Okay, a couple of things. First of all, I personally see nothing wrong with having computer chips in our heads, as long as they can't be hacked too easily. Just saying that for the record. And number two, as attached as some people may be to the notion that handwriting is a vital thing to teach our children, that attachment isn't as old as you might think.
If we just talk about the United States, we're really only talking about since maybe 1890 that you have this idea that all kids learn these things. It was not true before then. I would say at the beginning of the 19th century, you have the beginning of more public schools. where penmanship was taught. So it was always part of the American education, although there weren't as many Americans being educated. And then in the middle of the 19th century, you have the first sort of franchise, penmanship franchise, where Platt Rogers Spencer develops a script that is, he believes, is religiously infused and will make you become more moral and more Christian and in tune with nature. And it really sweeps the nation and everyone starts adopting that script. He would be replaced by Palmer, who's more familiar to us now, whose Palmer method comes around at the late 19th century, and it is aimed to be a more masculine and industrial script for the more, you know, industrial age. And then that becomes really the one way that every American is taught their scripts until the second half of the 20th century, where it sort of fragments.
I see. And when did penmanship or handwriting become associated with intelligence and virtue?
It's associated with virtue all the way through. And the virtue shifts as the culture does. And it's certainly a sign of being upstanding to have proper penmanship.
It was not always thus. Writing was, for most of human history, primarily utilitarian. The earliest handwriting, cuneiform, appeared 5,000 or 6,000 years ago.
Often it would be like a receipt. I just gave you 5 sheep. Here, I am just confirmed that I received 5 sheep. People would use a stylus and they would make marks and incisions in the wet clay. And that was really the first writing.
And what does cuneiform look like to us? Does it look more like kind of shorthand than shaped letters that we would recognize?
Well, they're not letters, right? So it's a writing system that uses, it looks like, you know what? A golden gram. That's a terrible...
Yes,
there was this great picture of a... Cuneiform was often done on very small pieces of clay, and the script is tiny. And so if you look at it, it can actually look a little bit like a golden gram. It's just little lines.
You're saying that would be... A golden gram would be like the size of one of these little clay tablets?
Some of them are very small, and the script is really small. It is smaller than what you have on a penny or a dime. Smaller than that.
Tangential, but can we agree that golden grams are among the best cereals there are? Aren't they great?
You know, now that I think about eating them as little clay tablets, I'm really in favor of them. But for the most part, it seems that most of the early writing systems that were developed, some of them were developed independently, were created for accounting purposes. It is really a very unromantic answer to anyone who thinks, you know, great literature and writing. They were to record those sheep sales.
Which tells us what about, let's say, the teaching of that scripting, that it or maybe the practice. Was it done by just a very few people? Were there only a few scribes who did it? Or do you think it was just so universally taught that it was identical?
It was restricted, but it was far less restricted than it would be in Egypt, where almost nobody was allowed to learn how to write. But to me, it undergirds that idea that handwriting is not innately a way to express some inner part of yourself. The notion that handwriting is connected to our individual expression is a very 20th century idea.
So the significance of handwriting has changed over the centuries, but so too has the technology, from clay to parchment to paper to screens, from stylus to quill to pen to keyboard and, again, the stylus. As Anne Trubeck sees it, moving from handwriting to keyboarding is a good thing, if only because it doesn't penalize people with poor fine motor skills or other issues that make it hard to write with a pen and paper.
There is a truly democratizing effect to having students move to keyboards.
Rather than putting so much effort into handwriting, we're freed up to concentrate on what matters most, the words and the ideas. But some studies show that the act of handwriting is better for the brain than keyboarding. Also, that we express more ideas when writing by hand.
Hi, my name is Pam Mueller. I just finished my PhD in social psychology at Princeton.
Mueller was a teaching assistant in an introductory psychology class.
Usually I would bring my laptop to class to take notes in case students had questions later, but one day I'd forgotten it and I took notes in a notebook. And I thought I got so much more out of the lecture that day than I had out of any other lecture. And I told him that after class.
Him being Daniel Oppenheimer, the professor teaching the class.
A few days later, he had a similar experience at a faculty meeting where he was typing notes, realized he had written everything down but had no idea what anyone was saying. So since we had these parallel intuitions, we thought we should test them scientifically.
Mueller and Oppenheimer conducted a series of experiments at Princeton and UCLA. For instance, they would ask a bunch of students to watch a TED Talk, take notes on it, and then later answer some test questions.
We gave them a 10-question test that had both factual questions and conceptual questions.
But before watching the TED Talk, the students would be split into two groups. One, it was instructed to take notes on a laptop, the other by hand.
What we found was that for factual questions, there was no difference between laptop and longhand note takers. They did equally well. However, for conceptual questions, the longhand note takers did significantly better, about half a standard deviation better.
The laptop note takers were able to write down much more information, about 50% more. But the information didn't serve them as well.
And this appeared to be due to the fact that the laptop note takers took more verbatim notes, signaling that they were processing the content less than the longhand note takers.
Now, why would that be? Mueller's argument is that because handwriting is slower, you're forced to decide as you go what's worth writing down. And this gets your brain engaged in processing the information as you go.
And when you process something more deeply, it's more likely to stick.
There's also the possibility that taking notes by hand is just harder.
There is such thing as a desirable difficulty. Having a little bit of difficulty when you're trying to learn something is actually beneficial. And, you know, longhand note taking might be just that for us.
But maybe it wasn't the laptops per se that were the problem. Maybe it's how we tend to use laptops.
So we wanted to see if we could get laptop note takers to not take verbatim notes.
They considered a variety of ideas.
Like taping people's hands together or slowing down their keyboard so they could only type as fast as they could longhand write, or, you know, making them wear gloves. But ultimately, we went with the simplest, which was to give them an explicit instruction not to take verbatim notes, telling them that verbatim note-taking led to poor performance and to really try not to do this.
They redid the experiment, but once again, the people who took notes by hand did better. And what happened to the laptop note takers who were told that typing verbatim notes would hurt them?
They took pretty much exactly as many verbatim notes as the uninstructed laptop students. So it seems like that's going to be a very difficult tendency to break.
Processing the information as you go, what we call encoding, is not the only value of note taking. There's also the external storage function, that is, creating a record for future reference. So if you have a chance to review your notes, which didn't happen in Mueller and Oppenheimer's first two studies, wouldn't it be better to have a more complete set of notes?
So in study three, we brought students into the lab, showed them lectures, and then we brought the students back into the lab a week later, and some of them were given 10 minutes to study their notes before we gave them the test. Another group of students was not given this opportunity just to sort of replicate the previous design.
Okay, so now you're thinking, finally, the laptop note takers will prevail. But no.
For the students who got to study their notes, the longhand note takers still did better. And in this case, they did better on both factual and conceptual questions. So that was a huge surprise for us. But it seems that if students didn't process the content as it was being presented, just looking back at their notes later was not a good enough refresher for their memory. So processing it while it's being presented seems much more effective than writing it all down and thinking, I'll just think about this later.
Mueller is not a technophobe. She doesn't expect or want laptops to go away.
My co-author and I do believe that if we could get people to use their laptops more like they are currently writing longhand, they would benefit.
But how to accomplish that?
I think that it might take some sort of more mechanical intervention, like a note-taking app that only allows you to write X words per minute or something. Either that or more training from a younger age about the best ways to use technology like a laptop in the classroom.
Or is it worth thinking about a different kind of note-taking entirely? Still written by hand, but much faster and more efficient than standard longhand. Coming up on Freakonomics Radio,
the typical person writing in cursive probably writes maybe a shade over 30 words a minute. I would say my average speed is, let's say, 150, 120 words a minute.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
When we started work on this episode, I had no idea that people would be so rabid in their defense or hatred of handwriting, but I probably shouldn't have been so surprised. If you write books, as I do, whenever you do a bookstore reading and you get to the Q&A session at the end, someone always asks, so what do you write with? Do you use pen and paper, pencil, a computer, a typewriter? And I used to laugh off the question, but I don't anymore. I've come around. Because when something's going on in your brain and you want to transfer it to another medium, the means of doing that is important. Here is a Freakonomics Radio listener named Mike Miller.
I find that I generally use handwriting for starting creative projects or writing creatively, just for the fact that a pen on paper allows you a lot more freedom to write, and also computers tend to have a lot of distractions associated with them, such as pop-up windows and different formatting styles.
Okay, for what it's worth, I do just about all my writing on a computer. I do sometimes use pen and paper for outlining and for making to-do lists, which I do several times a day. And I print. I hated cursive when I was a kid, and I hate it now. But all the real composing I do happens on a computer. However, after I write something, whether it's a book chapter or a script or a lecture, I always print it out and then do a very vigorous edit on paper with a pen. Now, this may be as much about reading as writing, but for whatever reason, it's easier for me to trim and to reorganize the material on paper with a pen. I appreciate that different people have different preferences. My own kids, one of them reads books almost exclusively on an e-reader, but prefers to write with pen and paper. And my other kid, he reads only real paper books, but everything he writes is on a computer. So I get the divide, especially when it comes to preferences. But when it comes to utility, to the need to write down information for whatever reason, wouldn't it be nice if there was a hybrid, something faster than handwriting and more organic than keyboarding?
When I go around and I'm taking notes in shorthand, people always tell me, oh, my mother wrote shorthand, or my grandmother wrote shorthand.
That's Dennis Ollier. He's a journalist and a shorthand aficionado.
I do a lot of walking, talking interviews, especially for like nature stories and that sort of thing. So you certainly can't type away on your laptop then. And also I find that even in-person interviews in general, a laptop comes between you and the person you're talking to.
So Ollier was looking for a better way of taking fast, accurate handwritten notes. Cursive, even though it's faster than printing, wasn't nearly fast enough.
When it comes to speed, cursive is only about 10% faster than printing. That's because cursive letters are often more complicated than print letters. The only speed advantage is that you're not picking up your pen as you go.
Ollier taught himself shorthand from an old textbook he found in a used bookstore. It taught the Gregg method. That's one G at the front and two at the end. Gregg was one of many shorthand systems.
As long as there have been people taking down notes of their, of the, you know, the vizier or the king or the court or whatever, they've had to write in some kind of shorthand. And so there are literally thousands of versions of shorthand.
Eventually, there were some winners.
You ended up with a few, let's call them popular systems. So there was Pittman shorthand and Gregg shorthand.
These two shorthand giants pretty much divvied up the world.
You know, kind of like the Portuguese and the Spanish divvied up the world. The two systems, Gregg and Pittman, were in great competition because these weren't just systems of writing. These were big corporations, and they were fighting it out for publishing rights in schools and certification programs and that sort of thing.
Which makes it sound as if shorthand was big business, and for a time, it was.
Every high school in America used to teach Gregg, and certainly every business school that you went to, and all the universities would have Gregg courses. It was a major career path for women, of course.
Because back when women had such limited career options, they were often steered onto a secretarial track, and in the pre-computing age, shorthand was a key secretarial skill.
The typical person writing in cursive probably writes maybe a shade over 30 words a minute. I would say my average speed is, let's say, 150 and 120 words a minute.
Now, that's considerably faster than most people type. So how does it work? How does a shorthand system like Greg allow you to write so fast?
I should point out that maybe the most obvious speed gained in shorthand is that it's phonetic. You don't write any letters that aren't there, that you don't hear.
Okay, got it. No wasted letters. What else?
The letters in Greg are just much simpler than the letters in the Roman alphabet, which is what most of us use. Where if you take a B, for example, even if you write in cursive, a B is an upward stroke, a downward stroke, a little loop at the bottom, and a little ligature to connect to the next letter. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4 strokes to write one letter. In Greg, it's a simple downward stroke of a curve open to the right.
Then there's what are called blends.
Not only do you not pick up your pen between letters in a word, but frequently you put together words into phrases. These are very common phrases that we use constantly. And because we know that they go together constantly, we can write that all in one fluid string of strokes. For example, the expression, it will be, in Greg is written in 3 quick strokes that you don't pick up your pen. So it's as fast as writing the letter H, for example.
Greg also uses something called short forms.
Which is a form of abbreviation, I guess you could say, where for very common words, you can often write them with a single stroke. So if you write the letter R, for example, by itself, it can be the word our, O-U-R, the word our, H-O-U-R, or the word R, A-R-E.
All this efficiency adds up to huge speed gains. So if your goal is to write down a lot of information accurately, shorthand would seem to be a great system. And when you think about it, isn't it a little nuts that the handwriting we all learn in school, whether it's printing or cursive, is based on ancient letters that require so many strokes? Why didn't we all just learn shorthand instead? And maybe it's not too late?
So what you're saying is that everybody learns shorthand instead of the alphabet.
That's Ann Trubeck, the handwriting scholar.
I think if you're talking about maximum efficiency, then maybe you're right. And you're stumping me here.
Yes, I have at least one vote for my idea.
Yeah, I know this shorthand. I mean, it's fascinating, and I love it because it's a sort of subculture of language and writing. But I'd never thought about if it had just been, it would have been the new alphabet.
Alas, we went instead in the opposite direction. Rather than taking over the world, shorthand was marginalized. It's still learned in some places. In Britain, for instance, many journalists still routinely use it. But for the most part, the shorthand boom is long gone. Dennis Ollier tells us that not a single American high school still teaches the Greg system. What killed it off? Modernism in various forms. The stenography machine, the dictaphone, and of course the personal computer. A boss no longer needed a secretary to take his rapid-fire dictation and type it up later. Now he could put down his brilliant ideas all by himself on his desktop PC. Ollier tells this story in a wonderful Atlantic piece called How to Write 225 Words a Minute with a Pen. So you'd think that Ollier would also be in favor of shorthand triumphalism. But he's not.
The problem is, because it was designed for speed, people, as they become faster, their writing becomes less and less legible to other people and more legible only to themselves. And even for those of us who understand Greg pretty well, it can take half an hour to figure out 5 minutes worth of somebody's shorthand.
And there's another way in which shorthand may be less valuable than longhand. When you're really fast at shorthand, you're getting into verbatim territory, which means the encoding value of handwriting may disappear.
I can't look back in my mind and see my shorthand notes. And in fact, the way you become really fast at shorthand is not to think at all. You're ideally, you've absorbed the rules of shorthand so that as someone is speaking, your hand is moving without you thinking about it. And so there's no real processing going on there. And you have to stop every once in a while and remember to try and be intelligent when you're doing your interview.
Okay. So there may be no perfect solution to a task like note-taking, and of course different people have different preferences, but here's one more thing to consider. In a world where we all type more and handwrite less, our school systems still spend a lot of time teaching young children to perfect their handwriting. Wouldn't that time be better spent on something else?
Right.
Ann Trubeck again.
I mean, I would say that if you perceive elementary education as preparing students for education, knowledge, citizenship, then there's too much time spent on it. It won't prepare them. It does not set them up for what will happen to them beyond third grade, really. By high school, many things are typed. So it does prepare them for more school, but not much beyond that.
How do you see the future of handwriting playing out?
It will continue to diminish in our everyday lives as people going about our business and as workers, as it has already. It will become more of an art form in both education and outside of traditional curriculum and be seen more as a fine motor skill. And then also, you know, we'll have that panache of retro cool, you know, in the short-term future like typewriters do now.
Mm. So I have to say, if I am running a pen company, I do not like your message.
Yes. Yes, I would think so.
So short pens is the message of the day.
Short pens, and when you read studies about how cursive helps you become smarter, look to see who funds those.
Ah, tell me.
Well, there are some very powerful companies that make their money off of penmanship and curriculum, and they also fund research studies.
Some research, like Pam Mueller's work on laptop versus handwritten note-taking, is independent, but it is true that the value of handwriting is often trumpeted by companies who stand to gain from keeping handwriting in schools and elsewhere. Zahner Bloser, a top publisher of handwriting curriculum materials, has sponsored conferences and studies that argue for the importance of handwriting and cursive. The Bic Pen Company launched a public education campaign to save handwriting. It's called Fight for Your Right, W-R-I-T-E. And then there are those who defend handwriting, especially cursive, on the grounds that it is just a part of who we are.
A lot of people really connect it to these ideas about being an educated citizen. And it's hard for them to conceive that you would not consider being able to master print and cursive as a requirement for becoming an educated citizen of the United States. It's very interesting to me to see the rhetoric they use. It's often connected to other values like saying the Pledge of Allegiance in school each day or having school uniforms. You know, cursive becomes a sort of marker of traditional values.
But I mean, even if you hate handwriting and the teaching thereof, you can probably identify with that sentiment, right? I mean, there are certain things that we cling to, whether as Americans or humans or whatever, moderns, that we do only because they connect us to a past that is, if not better or richer in some way, is at least our past. So can you identify with that link to tradition and at least empathize with it?
I completely understand it. If there is less printing and cursive done, it's undeniable that there's a loss. But if you look at the history of writing and you look at the history of technology, there is always loss with change. There was huge losses when the printing press was developed. There were huge losses when writing was invented. Socrates, he really worried about what writing would do to civilization, because imagine, literally right now, if you could never look anything up. If you live in an oral culture, you can never look anything up. And your memory is vast. Your ability to recall things in your head, as it were, is much larger than those who live in a literate culture. It's another wonderful example of how we lose something when we shift from one writing technology to another. We have lost those amazing minds of oral cultures, but we have gained something really significant, which is writing and history and all the things that come with that. So, you know, my point is really, yeah, it's sad, it's a loss, but loss is part of change, and things will change, and it will be okay.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we revisit a famous essay, famous in the world of economics at least, called I, Pencil. That's right, it's told in the voice of the pencil.
Well, to begin with, my story is interesting.
And what is the pencil's message?
You realize there isn't a single person in the world who would really understand how to make a pencil from scratch, from the raw materials.
coming up next on Freakonomics Radio. And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts, or at Freakonomics.com, where you can also find our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
I'm Stephen Dubner. This is Freakonomics Radio. We've been discussing the decline of an everyday activity.
Handwriting's going away.
Ann Trubeck studies the history of handwriting and handwriting technology. In a world that is increasingly digital, Trubeck argues, teaching handwriting in schools is time poorly spent.
I think it will continue to diminish in elementary education. It will continue to diminish in our everyday lives as it has already.
And as handwriting diminishes, so does our need for writing instruments.
The numbers of examples of things that you still need to be able to use a pen or pencil and paper in the ordinary course of a workday, it's shrinking.
Indeed. The market research firm Euromonitor International has found that in the U.S. at least, the sales of writing instruments has had 5 years of consecutive decline, with a forecast for more of the same. That said, sales of pens have been rising slightly. It's the pencil that is fading in the bright light of the digital age. Global pencil sales this year are expected to reach just $2.6 billion. That means that someone like, say, Steven Spielberg could buy up every single new pencil this year around the world and still have $1 billion left for popcorn or pie or a dozen Gulfstream G650s. And yet, despite the small and shrinking stature of the lowly pencil...
Hi.
Hello.
Good morning. Do you happen to have any pencils I'm looking for?
Many pencils.
I'm Stephen.
Caroline.
Nice to meet you.
There is a new shop in New York City, a tiny storefront on the Lower East Side, whose stock is most singular.
We sell only pencils. New pencils, rare pencils, antique pencils, novelty pencils, pencil accessories.
Caroline Weaver is the proprietor of CW Pencil Enterprise.
I grew up in Marietta, Ohio, which is in the southeast corner of Ohio, just across the river from West Virginia.
Weaver is only 25 years old, which is young to be the proprietor of any shop, much less a pencil shop. But then after you speak with her a bit, it's hard to imagine Weaver doing anything else.
It was just kind of a lifelong obsession.
On the inside of her left forearm is a pencil tattoo.
My mother drew it for me. I asked her to take a black Ticonderoga, sharpen it 3 times, and draw it to scale. And that's what she did.
And you can surely guess what Weaver and a friend dressed up as for Halloween.
We both wore these paper pencil point hats that we made, and we wore pink shoes like an eraser, and then painted whatever the logo of our pencil on our clothes.
What is it about the pencil that so captured Caroline Weaver's imagination?
I like to make things, and I'm really interested in the way that things are made. And so at a really young age, I developed an interest in these objects that appear to be really, really simple, but are actually very complicated in the nature in which they're made and kind of the nuances to all of the parts that they're made of.
She sells American pencils, Japanese and German and British and Swiss and Indian pencils.
Every country kind of has its own normal as far as pencils go, and often those things aren't available outside of their home countries.
So talk for just a second about the economics of your shop.
Mm-hmm.
Is it profitable?
Believe it or not, it is profitable. It turns out there are a lot of closet pencil nerds out there who want these things as much as I do.
But let me tell you why we're really here today. It is not just to celebrate a young entrepreneur with narrow tastes, nor is it simply to gawk at the variety of her collection, variety in color, in country of origin, even in cost. Some pencils can be had for as little as 30 cents. Some vintage pencils go for $75 a piece. But no, that's not why we're here. We are here to see one particular pencil, which is so unassuming, so typical in its pencilness, that I didn't even realize Weaver had opened a drawer and pulled out a box of them.
It's pretty sharp.
Oh, this is the 482.
That is the 482, yeah. It's a classic Mongol.
The Mongol 482 may be just a middle-range everyday pencil, but it's also one of the most famous pencils in history, famous at least in economics, because the Mongol 482 has written its autobiography.
My family tree begins with what, in fact, is a tree, a cedar of straight grain that grows in Northern California and Oregon.
It is a complex story about how a simple thing comes into being.
If I really wanted to, I could probably make a pencil.
But could you really, Caroline Weaver? Could you really? Let's begin in 1946. That's when a man named Leonard Reed starts an organization called the Foundation for Economic Education, or FEE. The FEE is a think tank meant to extol the virtues of free market capitalism. It's an early proponent of libertarianism in the U.S. Reed was a businessman from Michigan. He started out in wholesale groceries, later ran the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce. In 1958, the FEE published an essay written by Reed called I Pencil.
I am a lead pencil, the ordinary wooden pencil familiar to all boys and girls and adults who can read and write.
Yes, the essay is told in the voice of the pencil, as voiced here by Robert Krulwich of Radiolab. Specifically, the pencil is an Eberhard Faber Mongol 482.
You may wonder why I should write a genealogy.
Which is a bit weird, but also, this pencil has a chip on its shoulder.
Sadly, I'm taken for granted by those who use me as if I were a mere incident and without background.
The pencil is also a bit of a braggart.
I have a profound lesson to teach.
But you know what? It does have a profound lesson to teach. I Pencil has become a classic in the canon of economics literature, translated into every major language.
It's rather beautifully written, this essay.
That's Matt Ridley. He's a science writer, also a British Viscount, and a member of the House of Lords. He's been very much influenced by the ideas of I Pencil.
And it really struck me between the eyes, because this essay is at once both extremely obvious, when you think about it, and extremely revelatory.
Hello, hello, this is Tim.
And that is Tim Harford, an economist.
Sometimes known as the undercover economist. I write books of that title and a Financial Times column.
Tim Harford and Matt Ridley are going to help us retell the pencil's autobiography, which is really more of a parable. It first conveys a set of facts, then it reaches a shallow conclusion and ultimately a deeper conclusion.
Just as you can't trace your family tree back very far, so it is impossible for me to name and explain all my antecedents. But I would like to suggest enough of them to impress upon you the richness and complexity of my background.
While researching the essay, Leonard Reed visited an Eberhard Faber pencil factory in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. What he found was a supply chain that even in the 1950s reached around the globe. Let's start with the wood.
My family tree begins with what, in fact, is a tree, a cedar of straight grain that grows in Northern California and Oregon.
Think about all the processes, all the people who were involved in cutting down those trees and in machining those trees, the people who designed the chainsaws and the axes and the trucks that shipped the cedar across country.
Why, untold thousands of persons had a hand in every cup of coffee that the loggers drink.
Next, the pencil tells us the logs were shipped to a mill in San Leandro, California.
And there they were milled and cut into pencil-like shapes.
The pencil acknowledges all the workers who built the hydroelectric dam that powers the mill. And then there's the lead.
Which, of course, is not made of lead.
Is graphite mined from Ceylon, Sri Lanka, mixed with clay, paraffin wax, candelilla wax, and hydrogenated natural fats. Did we know that? No, we didn't.
And here, the pencil nods toward all the graphite miners, the men who built the ships that transport the graphite, the harbor pilots who guide those ships in from the sea.
Even the lighthouse keepers along the way assisted in my birth.
And then there's the lacquer, the paint that gives the Mongol 482 its bright yellow color.
My cedar receives 6 coats of lacquer.
The lacquer is made with oil from castor beans and a load of other ingredients.
Why, even the process by which the lacquer is made a beautiful yellow involved the skills of more persons than one can enumerate.
The number of people involved in creating this pencil is enormous.
And then he goes into the same detail about the ferrule, which is the brass metal at the end of the pencil.
The brass on the top of the pencil, the so-called ferrule, is made from zinc and copper, which have to be mined.
Again, many, many hands involved, many machines, many processes. The same goes for the eraser, which you might think is made of rubber. I thought it was made of rubber, but it's actually made from
rapeseed oil mixed with sulfur chloride and pumice and calcium sulfide to give it color and that kind of thing. All these incredible ingredients going into this very simple object.
The pencil explains all this detail, but in each case, the pencil is pointing out that there are these global supply chains, there are all of these different inventions going way back in history, all of these different people involved. And if you put it all together, you realize there isn't a single person in the world who would really understand how to make a pencil from scratch, from the raw materials.
Simple, yet not a single person on the face of this earth knows how to make me.
This is the shallow conclusion of iPencil.
Actually, millions of human beings have had a hand in my creation, no one of whom even knows more than a very few of the others. There isn't a single person in all these millions, including the president of the pencil company, who contributes more than a tiny, infinitesimal bit of know-how.
It's a bold claim the pencil makes. Not a single person knows how to make me, but the claim would seem to be justified. And it's an interesting way of looking at the world, yes? At how interdependent we are, how specialized we are. The deeper conclusion that Leonard Reed was making, however, this is where things get really interesting.
The miracle of this pencil isn't that nobody knows how to make it. The miracle of the pencil is, how did it get made?
That's Milton Friedman, one of the giants of modern economics. In 1980, he made a public TV series called Free to Choose, based on his book of the same name. He borrowed Leonard Reed's parable.
This is the only prop I have for this TV show. As you can see, it's a plain yellow pencil.
The miracle that allows for the pencil to be made, Friedman says, is the price mechanism that lets buyers meet sellers and which makes free markets flow freely.
I am trading with thousands of people all over the world. Not one of them has been forced to do it. Nobody has had a gun to his head. They've all done it. Why? Because each one of them thinks he's better off in this transaction.
You might know this concept as the invisible hand, as the proto-economist Adam Smith named it, which suggests, as the pencil puts it,
the absence of a mastermind, of anyone dictating or forcibly directing these countless actions which bring me into being.
In other words, none of the millions of people involved, directly or indirectly, in making a pencil cared one bit about making a pencil. Maybe didn't even know what they were making.
Not one of them is motivated by making a pencil. They're motivated by earning money, providing for their family. And the astounding thing, as Leonard Reed says, is the absence of a mastermind. There is no one dictating or forcibly directing these countless actions, as he put it.
So the deeper conclusion of iPencil is that a well-oiled free market can create something that even an alchemist wouldn't dream of. Now, this may not be the way you see free market capitalism. And let's be honest, there are market failures. There are segments of the economy that seem stacked against small players or are too susceptible to self-dealing or corruption. But the point is that free market capitalism is better than all the known alternatives. Now, let's keep in mind that Leonard Reed, writing in 1958, and even Milton Friedman, speaking in 1980, were responding to a different political climate. They were both concerned about the legacy of Roosevelt's New Deal programs and the growing involvement of the government in American economic life. They were also concerned about communism and what they saw as the tyranny of state-run economies in places like the Soviet Union. Just listen to the pencil.
If you can become aware of the miraculousness which I symbolize, you can help save the freedom mankind is so unhappily losing.
The freedom mankind is so unhappily losing. Reed sounds worried. Worried that the U.S. government and others like it were disastrously veering to the left. That the government wanted to get more involved in running things, and the governments don't always do such a great job of running things, especially when it comes to the economy. So Really, the deep, deep conclusion of iPencil is, hey, U.S. government, get out of the way.
Leave all creative energies uninhibited. Merely organize society to act in harmony with this lesson. Let society's legal apparatus remove all obstacles the best it can. Permit these creative know-hows freely to flow. Have faith that free men and women will respond to the invisible hand.
Does Leonard Reed's essay sound like libertarian propaganda? Of course it does. That's what it was, to some degree. So if you don't lean that way, you may not buy its message. There's also an argument to be made, as some people have made, that the pencil conveniently omitted some important facts from its autobiography, like all the goods and services the government provides that help, directly or indirectly, in the pencil's manufacture and sale. The roads that moved the lumber and other materials, the public schools that educated the loggers and the mill workers, the same schools that, at least in 1958, would have ordered thousands upon thousands of pencils for their students. And then there are the less tangible things, like a legal system to uphold contracts and the protections provided by police and the courts. Here again is the economist Tim Harford.
Clearly, in a modern economy, a tremendous amount of the infrastructure that we rely on has been paid for by taxpayers and coordinated in some way by state government, local government, or by the federal government. Some of these things could be provided privately, but as a matter of fact, they are provided by government, and they seem to be provided reasonably well.
So if your takeaway from iPencil is that governments should get completely out of the way,
I think that's an extreme reading. It's not impossible to read it that way, but you're really pushing it. If your reading, however, is the free market can do a lot, it does amazing things, and government should be careful before it sort of stamps its great big boots all over free market process, then I think that that's a fair reading, and I think that's a wise warning.
It is a warning that Harford says is worth heeding, especially as we are collectively thinking about how to deal with things like climate change, income inequality, the stability of our financial system.
So there are all kinds of areas of the global economy where you could say, I'm not happy with what the free market is giving me. The lesson I draw from the story of iPencil is when you try to fix those problems, be humble, be careful, because they're far more complicated than you could possibly imagine. And any fix to, for example, the energy system is going to involve far more people and far more countries and far more technologies than you could imagine. And that doesn't mean that you should just leave the market to do everything, but it does suggest a particular way of solving problems.
And I guess in addition to requiring input from a lot of other people because of the complexity, it also implies that you may indeed, quote, solve one part of the problem, but that solution may indeed ripple up and turn into a bigger problem in another realm that you may not care about, but that actually does affect a lot of people. I mean, some kind of unintended consequence, I guess, yes?
So, yes, one lesson is that there will always be unintended consequences whenever you start messing around with a complex system. I think another lesson is that trial and error is a really important process. So this is the lesson I draw in my book, Adapt. You need to carry out lots of experiments, and you need to create a system that allows lots of experiments. So the free market system is an experimental system, but it's not the only experimental system. So if you're going to start messing with global supply chains, with the energy system, with the financial system, you want to make things work better, you are going to need to do that step by step, constantly gathering data about what's working and what's not, and running really good experiments. And I think where Leonard Reed was absolutely right was to suggest that when the free market works well, it delivers amazing results. Well, why does it deliver amazing results? One reason is because there's lots and lots of small experiments and lots of small failures. There are pencil manufacturers or lumberjacks or coffee companies or truck companies making bad decisions and going bankrupt all the time, but the system as a whole is resilient and stable and creative. And as Leonard Reed rightly pointed out, it produces miracles.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you cannot wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe. I'd also like to give a quick shout out to this station and all the public radio stations around the country who play Freakonomics Radio. We realize your airtime is incredibly valuable, and we are delighted you share it with us. So, thanks.